Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name is Jess Phillips, and this is Yours Sincerely. I've always been a prolific letter writer, both the good and bad kind, and know the power of putting words on paper. So in this podcast, I want to give my guests a chance to celebrate three people that mean the world to them. Someone they love, someone who's no longer around, and someone who doesn't realise how significant a role they've played in their lives. And when we've heard more about each person, they'll reveal how they would sign off each letter. Bryony Gordon is a journalist, author and podcaster, best known for her wide-ranging work on mental health. She hosts Bryony Gordon's Mad World, filled with intimate conversations about getting unwell and getting better. She has also written books including Mad Girl, A Happy Life with a Mixed Up Mind. Her next book, No Such Thing as Normal, comes out this month on January the 7th. And today, I'm excited to talk to her about the letters she would send to three people who mean the world to her. So, hello, Bryony. How are you?
I'm all the better for speaking to you, Jess.
Oh, it's been a long time since I've seen you, Bryony, properly face to face.
I feel like the last time was in that big church.
Yeah, we like to meet in a church.
Yeah, but it was your book, wasn't it?
It was my book.
And then before that, it was like on a barge.
Yeah, on a barge before I went on live television, which was an error in judgment on my part.
Anyway, it's nice to see you. It's a shame I can't actually see you. I can actually see you because I've got eyes. It's more like I can't be in the same room as you. But it's probably for the best.
So this podcast is all about letter writing. Are you much of a letter writer? You're a writer. You must write some letters.
I do often write letters that I don't ever send to get stuff off my chest. Like I think someone must have recommended this. Actually, no, it was when I was in rehab. It was recommended to write a letter but not send it, just to kind of put your feelings down. So yeah, there are a lot of unsent letters on my laptop.
Yeah, I have a lot of resignation letters from various different jobs, positions that I have written in the past that I have never sent, but I just have to get it off my chest. So I like write down angry, sort of terrible, self-indulgent often, like, and then don't send them. But and I find that that helps me get over things.
Yeah, it's always like, I always think my initial, like, I always, the people talk about having, like, in, like, 12-step fellowships or whatever, talking of rehab, people talk about having, like, a higher power. And originally I was expecting that to be, like, some spiritual kind of thing. But I realised what my higher power is. It's, like, my second thought. It's not my first thought. It's my second thought. It's like waiting a bit. Just is that a good idea, Bryony? Do you really need to say that? Probably not.
If everybody had that higher power, the world would be a considerably better place. To take your second feeling on things, your first feelings on things are often the wrong feeling. I find that with my brother's been on the 12-step program now for like 4 years. And I find that, you know, like you don't have to be religious, do you? But there is a sort of spiritual element to it, isn't there? That you have to sort of channel. So I don't know what his superpower is.
It's him. His sobriety. It's his superpower.
Sobriety.
His sobriety. That's my, yeah, higher power. It's the Coldplay song for me. That's what it is.
Did you have to do that thing where you go and say sorry to everybody? Like, making amends?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Did you write any letters to make amends? I won't ask you to
As I said, many letters. And yeah, I mean, I'm probably going to get told off by my sponsor now. So I should just be quiet because I'm not supposed to talk about any of this.
Are you not meant to talk about your amends? Well, as somebody who has had amends made to them, the funniest moment in the amend process for my brother was my husband, when he said, "What amends can I make to you?" And my husband just said, "I would like this conversation to end." I tell you what, the thing that you can do to make up to me, never talk to me about this ever again. I never want to have this conversation. I feel deeply awkward with this conversation. So let's just call it quits and finish here.
I didn't realise, like, my name is Earl. I mean, obviously I should have, but I was too...
I
was too lost in my own alcoholism to be paying that much attention. But I'm like, oh, it's the whole thing is basically this guy having to get sober and do the ninth step, which is make amends except when it's not safe for you to do so. Anyway, and I should shut up now. I mean, I won't shut up because that would make a terrible podcast. But I should stop talking about the 12 steps because I'll just get told off.
You'll get told off. I'll finish on my best 12 step stories. That the amends my kids ask for is that my brother always brings pickled onion monster munch to the house when he comes.
Oh my gosh.
And goes and sees any film they ever want to see at the cinema, ever. Like, everybody else went, just like, we just want to see you better. My kids were totally mercenary. We're just like, right, what can we get out of this? So he has to go to any film that they ever want to see at the cinema and no one else will take them. And that he has to bring pickled onion monster munch to the house.
Everybody
else just went like, just be a good dad. That's the amends you can make to us. My kids
pickled
were like,
onion,
pickled onion monster munch. We don't care if you're a crap dad. We just want the crisps.
Have
you got any letters of note? We've had people who've had letters from prime ministers. We've got people who've had letters from the Queen of Denmark.
No, I haven't had a letter from prime ministers. I haven't had any letters of note. Oh, I've had a letter from the Duchess of Sussex.
Oh, yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
That's mega.
We've exchanged a few notes. And I was embarrassed because my handwriting, like, I don't know if you know Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, she was like trained in calligraphy when she was young. So her writing is like really neat. And I sent her a card because we went out for lunch. And I just to thank her and say how, you know, lovely it was to meet her properly. And my handwriting is just dreadful, which is probably why I don't write more letters. The last letter I had to write was like to my daughter's teacher to tell her that someone was picking her up from school, and my daughter was like, I can't hand that to my teacher, Mum. That's really embarrassing. You wouldn't get your she was like, you would not get your pen license. And I'm like, all right. But anyway, so I wrote her a note and she wrote me back this like gorgeous, beautiful handwritten note. Not my daughter's teacher, Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex. And her writing was just delicious.
I mean, that's pretty good. So far, you're the only one who has really been like, they had great handwriting. So the Duchess of Sussex.
Yeah, that's all I've got. I mean, is that okay? It's like, can I?
That's literally, like, she's one of the most famous people in the whole world, I would argue. Yeah, that's definitely a letter of note.
Yeah, I haven't had any Christmas cards from any, like, former prime ministers, not from the current prime minister.
I've not had one from the current prime minister yet. Which is rude.
I mean, maybe my worry is that if he sat down and like started writing Christmas cards, people would be like, "What? Why are you doing, like, what the fuck are you doing? Writing Christmas cards? Have you got better things to be doing?"
Yeah, I mean, that he's got parties to attend.
He's got wine and cheese parties to attend.
So I have asked you to think about three different people that you would want to write a letter to tell them how much they mean to you. It's all very nice, no particular cynicism, although feel free to be cynical if you like. And the first letter I asked you to think about in the first person was somebody just who means the world to you. So who would that be?
Okay, so you are going to like, when I said, even just the thought of telling you who this person is makes me feel like violently unwell because it's it's so contrary to everything I would want to say, but... That's why I've chosen this person. And I want to write a letter to myself because, okay, I am so hard on myself. Like, so to kind of put some context in on this, I am, as you may have guessed, an alcoholic in recovery. I have like a history of mental health issues, obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, eating disorders. I could go on, I won't, because, you know, we want to be upbeat. But I am so hard on myself. The reason I've done it is because I kind of want to give permission to people to pat themselves on the back a bit and just, you know, that whole cheesy thing of self-love. But it's really important because if you don't have self-esteem, you're good for nothing, basically.
I know, it's been slightly hijacked, I'm going to say, by basically schmaltzy memes on the internet.
Yeah.
And prior to that, schmaltzy, like, interviews on telly. Like, but, it, you know, fundamentally, you know, it is quite important, even though it seems a bit schmaltzy.
It does seem a bit schmaltzy, but I do think, like, it's like the key to everything. It's the key to, and I certainly, I think in the last couple of years, while this pandemic's been banging on and on and on, like, it's fed into the very worst kind of elements of my head. So I always say that the things that all mental health issues have in common, from sort of anxiety to depression to eating disorders to psychosis and beyond, is that they work by isolating you, and they lie to you, and they tell you you're a freak, and they tell you you're alone, and they tell you no one's going to understand what you're going through. And we know, of course, that's not true, but they work by sort of isolation. And so when you have this state-sanctioned isolation and this sort of permission almost to be alone and to cut yourself off, I think that can be really bad for someone's mental health. And it's certainly been really bad for my mental health. So I basically sat in this bedroom where I'm talking to you for more or less the last 18 months, telling myself that I'm a piece of shit the world revolves around. And of course, it's not true. You know, everyone feels this way. But I think sometimes what I don't do is go, Bridie, you're all right. You know, you're actually all right. And I want to pat you on the back, and then we can just get on with life and stop being so kind of self-indulgently self-loathing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The trouble is even in your self-loathing, you're self-loathing because you're like, it's very self-indulgent of me. Like, I'm even, like, even the fact that I'm disliking myself is essentially an act of selfishness on my part.
But I do stop and I want to go, actually, Bridie, you are awesome. I'm not a bad person. And I've had obsessive compulsive disorder since I was a little girl. And I call, like, my OCD Jareth the Goblin King after the David Bowie character in Labyrinth, because it's like evil but ever so slightly enticing. And Jareth for my whole life has, like, told me I'm the worst person, that I might have a terrible illness that I'm going to spread to people, that I might, you know, if I don't say this phrase right, then my family are going to die, you know, which I've had since I was a little girl. And then later on, he's told me that I might be a serial killing paedophile who's blanked out in horror, and I'm a terrible human.
It's QAnon.
Yeah,
Jareth is definitely a member of QAnon.
I know, but look, this is really common with people with OCD, and so Jareth just spends the whole time basically trying to find ways to prove to me that I'm a bad person. And I'm not a bad person. I'm just a person. And sometimes I do bad things because people do, you know? But, like, mostly I've done bad things because of, say, alcoholism or stuff that I work on every day. So I want to write a letter to myself and just go, God, Bryony, you're pretty cool. Like, you're sober. I set up something called Mental Health Mates, which I want to talk a bit about later. And you ran a marathon in your underwear and you're, like, 16 stone. Like, what more do you want to achieve in your life, babes? You interviewed Prince Harry about his mental health. You know, like, you do good things. Just get on with it. It's fine.
What do you think? This is almost an impossible question to answer, and I would literally loathe it if somebody asked me. Like, what do you think is the best thing about you, Bryony? Isn't it awful that this is the conditioning? There are plenty of my colleagues in Westminster who wouldn't find it hard to answer that question. Because I could tell you what I think. What do you think is the best thing about you?
I don't know. Tell me what you think.
Well, I think you're caring, and you decided to use your platform for a purpose beyond your platforms, for a purpose beyond anything that could be deemed selfish. Although there'll be plenty of people who'll queue up and say the alternative to me, but why would you walk along and march along with a banner with them rather than with the people who think that you did a good thing and are kind? Also, I think you wear it lightly. Doing a thing like setting up a charity, like being some people's touchstone, even if it's just one or two people, let alone hundreds or thousands of people, and you wear it quite lightly. I mean, maybe because you're a bit mad and you hate yourself. Maybe we all need a little, you know, maybe that helps you wear it a bit lightly. But like, that's a really charming skill. Also, you're just a laugh as well, just like on a basic level, just a laugh.
I feel like everyone listening is going to be like, oh, she totally, like, talk about going on a fishing expedition. And that, again, is Jareth. Jareth's like, oh, you're such a dick, Bryony. I'm like, shut up, Jareth. I'm just a person. The best thing about me is that I'm uniquely me. And that's the best thing about everyone. Do you know what I mean? There's only one version of us. And, yeah, I do think I care. I mean, maybe I care too much sometimes.
It's like the kind of thing you say in a job interview. I mean, I just care too much.
Yeah.
I'm just too on time.
Yeah, I'm too on time. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, but so I really, what I want, the reason I did it, because essentially I'm a really selfless person, you know, I'm a really good person. And really why I've done this, chosen me, is because I want to give permission to anyone listening to go, yeah, you're pretty awesome. Do you know what I mean? And to say to them, you know, like, do pat yourself on the back, because, you know, we are way better than our brains will tell us, you know, we are on any given day. And we all think we're sort of the worst person and the only person thinking a certain way. And actually, the truth is, we're all just mad as a box of frogs, and sort of brilliantly mad as a box of frogs. So, you know, I just, that's why I chose me. But I do have, I mean, I have other people I would like gratitude, endless gratitude.
I mean, with regard to the other people, if you think you're so awful, not just you, Bryony, but others, if you think, like, you must think very little of the people who love you. Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh, that's a good point.
You know, like, so, like, my mates are excellent, so I must be all right. And if they're willing to do things for me and help me out and just be around me, I can't be all bad, can I? Is what I have to tell myself. I'm like, well, look, you know, I always just think, I can fit my husband and my kids on one sofa, and I just think, well, we're all just in this tiny little space, and that's all that we really need. And they're all right. So if they're all right, then I must be, you know, fair to middling.
You're brilliant. You're brilliant, Jez.
Oh,
you are
no.
Brilliant. You bring me, like, so much joy. And, yeah, I think that's true. I had never thought of that. That's a really good bit of advice to give people, actually.
Yeah, because people find it hard to advocate for themselves and think well of themselves because, well, fundamentally, because we were raised properly, basically, not to have too much of a bob on ourselves, not get above yourself, self-praise is no praise, etc., etc. Also, like, especially, like, by sort of baby boomer parents, they're very, like, you know, sort of, we lived through the war, and my dad is always just like, all right, love, take yourself down a peg or two, constantly. My husband once said I should write a self-help book called Take Yourself Down a Peg or Two. You're nowhere near as good as you think you are.
Yeah.
But, you know, we are able to see value in other people's views and opinions rather than in our own. So think, you know, if you've got lovely friends who seem to have good judgment in other regards, why would they be friends with you? Because I'm not friends with dickheads.
No way. Just Phillips is not friends with dickheads.
Not friends with dickheads.
That is true.
I have been. I've moved on and they've found other people who can get on with them better.
That is a good title for a book. I'm not friends with dickheads.
I'm writing it right now. So, how would you sign off the letter to yourself?
I was told to prepare this and, of course, I haven't.
I have literally never prepared for anything in my life, so worry not. I've had to stand up and talk about fisheries and thinking, I don't even know what fisheries means.
What are fisheries? My sign off my letter saying, Bryony, learn what fisheries are. I would sign off my letter going, you're doing all right, and fundamentally, you're doing your bloody best, and that's all any of us can ask for.
I think that is totally fair enough. Just crack on, love, doing as best you can.
Crack on.
When you said that, you know, obviously the isolation, there's been huge amounts of worry about people with mental health problems and the isolation that they must be feeling. And funnily enough, my brother, he gave me an alternative view with lots of the people he was, like, so his programmes went online and things. But he said that lots of the people who he works with were like, they quite like the instruction, like, do this at this time, do that. It's just like life became slightly simpler. It's just like, I don't have to make this decision. Stay at home. like,
I do find sometimes being in a lockdown isn't easy. But what I do think is, so the isolation, I think, is bad for people. But the other thing, which I think is not great, is that thing of every day. So, like, as that thing of, like, Nadine Dorris claimed that people's mental health had improved because they didn't have to commute to work. And I'm like, I mean, but the thing is, doing things that you don't want to do on the daily basis is actually really good for your mental health. So, like, one of the key things for good mental health, I think, is, you know, this connection with others, but also challenging yourself on a daily basis. So every day pre-pandemic, we had to challenge ourselves on a daily basis. Like, nobody wants to go to work and nobody wants to do that meme with that. Or watch, or anything. But every day you kind of prove yourself that you can do those things, and you're a bit of a legend, and you pat yourself on the back. And so, and of course, the pandemic is challenging. Like, don't get me wrong. And of course, this doesn't apply to people working in the front line or NHS, but sort of the more general population in office jobs, the less you challenge yourself, the more challenging life becomes. I mean, this is me speaking for myself. I found myself very depressed. And it's fine because I know what's the cause of it, but I can see it. It's what's unusual, because I'm quite used to depression. But what is unusual is the sense that everybody else is feeling it too. You know, like that isn't, you know, it's sort of baseline.
Yeah, for the first time, people who I'd never known experience anything beyond what would be the sort of acceptable norms of anxiety and depression. For the first time, I saw people who I never thought or expected finding it really, really difficult and challenging to be isolated and to not have any challenge in their lives, and also not have any sense of the sort of spur of the minute. There is no accidental, is there, in the pandemic. It's just like you get a Sainsbury's and you might bump into somebody, but you won't be like, let's go and get a sandwich together and a cup of coffee. Like, there's no incidental, you know, the sort of moments of hearing an aria if you were in a rom-com. There's no, like, meet-cutes. There is just the same thing. And that, I think, lots of people I know found it incredibly challenging. And I, yeah, saw for the first time people being properly, like, upset.
Well, depression, you know, if you think about depression and mental illnesses, and I kind of do, they're your brain's... your brain misfiring. They're sort of your brain, like, so depression is, so for OCD, for example, was my brain misfiring to try and keep me safe, but it doesn't work. But depression is your brain's way of trying to tell you that things aren't right in your life, really. I think lots of, I mean, there's people will go, no, that's bullshit, but, you know, there's a lot of psychotherapists who agree that it's a sort of, and it's your brain's way of saying something's not right here. We need to change things. So it absolutely makes sense that the sort of baseline,
something wasn't right, was it?
Yeah, mood of the nation is clinical depression, actually, you know. And that's not, like, I'm not saying everyone's depressed or anything like that, and I'm not, like, undermining the word or the illness as someone who's experienced it, but it's sad.
It was sad. Right, so the second letter I've asked you to prepare is about somebody who is no longer with you. So who would that be for?
So I'd like to write this letter to my friend Andrea Colville, who died in July 2019, just before the pandemic. So Andrea, she had something called autoimmune hepatitis, which is really rare, but it mostly affects women, and women is sort of childbearing age. So Andrea's developed while she was pregnant with her second child, and she died when he was 10 months old. It sort of came out of, it really did feel like it came out of nowhere. And she's so vibrant, and she's so, you know, like, I sort of wanted to talk to her age to sort of, like, raise a bit of awareness about autoimmune hepatitis. So I know there's lots of people that live with autoimmune disorders, and there's an amazing, her husband, Rob, my mate, has set up a fund with the Medical Research Foundation, and they're raising funds to, you know, to look into these autoimmune conditions, because there's not much research into them. It's not, listen, this isn't something that happens all the time, so I don't want to, like, put the fear of God into people. But it happened to her. Andrea was just a joyous person. So she was waiting for a liver transplant. And I remember going to see her in hospital in King's. I remember sitting there, and even at her illest, she was sort of laughing and joking with me. And she was, we were sort of joking, like, how unfair it was that Andrea, who barely drank a drop, was in the, you know, waiting for a liver transplant. And then there's, you know, and the alcohol, you know, she was like, I've got so many alcoholic friends. Why am I the one that's here? In the letter, I wanted to say to her that her sons are like, they're doing really well. So her first son is my godson. And, you know, like, when you take on that godparent role, you don't really, like, you just think, oh, that's not, like, no one ever, like, Edward's my first godchild, and no one had ever asked me to look up, to, like, be a godparent before. So it was, like, the moment where I was like, oh, someone thinks I'm a grown-up. I was like, I can't believe it. And, you know, the role essentially is if something happens to the parents or... But anyway, so I really wanted to sort of tell her a bit about Edward and Alexandra and, you know, and how they're thriving and how Rob is doing a fucking brilliant job of bringing them up, and how, you know, her mum and dad are still just like huge parts of their lives and always will be, and how much everyone misses her, really. Wishes that she was here. So yeah, I don't, you know, it was just I think about her quite a lot. I don't, you know, she comes to me and I'll dream about her sometimes. And so
do you like it when you dream about her?
Yeah,
I lost my mum when I was 29, and I don't really dream about her anymore, but when I do, I'm utterly thrilled when I wake up. It is like, I really like it when I dream about her.
Yeah,
it's a nice thing.
Yeah, I can hear her voice now in my head, you know. And you know, Rob is like amazing, and he's just sort of gets on with stuff, but you know, he just does a great job with them.
Did you expect him to?
No, of course I didn't. Poor Rob. No, of course I...
No, but that's, I mean, that is my, I've got two friends, two male friends, who both lost their wives suddenly, one to cancer, one Joe Cox's husband. And, like, you know, I didn't think that they were going to make, like, a hash of it, but, like, I never expected them to be as good as they've been.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you could only sort of go, what would I, you know, I imagine I'd be a mess. And, yeah, he's just fantastic. We had lunch with them on Sunday, and they're just, the two of the little boys are just gorgeous, and I love being around them. And, yeah, but he has done an amazing job. And I guess you just have to get on with it, don't you? Because like a 10-month-old and a 4-year-old, they're going through their own thing. But they're, you know, a 10-month-old is, oh, God, just... And he, the 10-month-old, looks so much like her. It's just kind of really lovely to see that. I don't have anything particularly articulate to say here. I just wanted to kind of like mention her, talk about her, talk about the Medical Research Foundation and the amazing work that they're doing, and, you know, and big up Rob. And also Andrea's mum, Sue, and her dad, Pat, they're like amazing. They're like legends. And I just, you know.
Did she know how much she meant to you?
I don't think she did. No, no, I don't think she did. So, you know, we had our kids at the same time, and I don't know, she was part of like the stability. Like we all, like, Rob met her and I met my husband at the same time, and we all like, I don't know. And it's like, sometimes you just take people for granted. Do you know what I mean? They're like, they're there and they're fun and they're there on the weekends away, and you're having, you know, I remember we'd go for like runs and, you know, huff and puff, and, you know, and then they're not, you know. I didn't, before she got ill, I didn't really see her for like 6 months before she got ill. And yeah, and you just realise life is like so all over the place. And I just think if there are people in your life who are just fucking awesome, just tell them. You know, I was thinking about this. I have a friend who's not very well at the moment, and I just was like, I'm just going to send them a message and tell them that they are like a glorious human being, and their illness can't take that away from them. And even if their illness physically takes their body from us, it can't take that soul ever, and what that soul has given to the world. So yeah, I'm not, this isn't articulate at all, and I apologise.
No, but the thing is you don't have to be articulate, because your friend died, and that's really, really shit and really, really sad. But the thing that you want to tell her is that everything's okay. You still want to be like a friend to her and alleviate her worry? Like, you're trying to alleviate, you know, the worry that you inevitably everybody would feel, like, shit, is he going to remember to buy the right Christmas presents? Or, like, is he going to fall apart? And is, like, are they going to be okay? Are they going to be traumatized? Like that's the, all the things that would go through your head. And still, as your friend, what you want to do, even though she's not here, is make her feel better about things being okay. And also, just, like, things are okay, aren't they? Like, mostly shit happens to everybody, and really shit things happen to some people, and it's just unfair. But, you know, it's amazing what we can cope with.
Yeah. And then, you know, and that thing of, like, she's not forgotten.
She'll never be forgotten.
No. You
know? Yeah, she's definitely not forgotten. I'm going to go and research autoimmune hepatitis, especially if it especially affects women, because that is often the problem with rare diseases. If you don't get, like, breast cancer or prostate cancer, if you get, like, a rare disease, there is all sorts of problems with diagnostics, and then issues around access to research, because the pools of people to do it with aren't big. And the women thing, especially women of childbearing age, they often, the excuse they will lead back on is those women don't want to be experimented on, essentially, which no one ever actually tries or puts any money into it. So do that.
And the Medical Research Foundation are fantastic. You know, they raise money for those illnesses, which other people, you know, don't. So a big shout out to them and all the brilliant people doing hard work with them.
Brilliant. So how would you sign off your letter to Andrea?
You are still very much here with us.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it? At my mum's funeral, my brother made a speech, and he said that, you know, like, you gave us a library's worth of inspiration, so we just go and take out a book whenever we need one. So you're still there, really. And that is a nice thing. We'll be back for Bryony's final letter after a short break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right then, so the final letter I have asked you to prepare is a letter to somebody who doesn't know that they've had an effect on your life, that doesn't realise how important they might have been to you.
Okay, so this person doesn't know, partly because they're dead, long dead, but also because, you know, I've never met them. So it's a writer. She's a writer called Carson McCullers. And Carson McCullers, she wrote this... She died quite young, but she wrote this brilliant book when she was 23 called The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. I had never heard of her until 2016. And in 2016, I was really unwell. Like, I had a really terrible obsessive compulsive disorder. I was still in kind of active addiction, but I was in denial. And anyway, I forced myself out for a run or kind of jog in my local park. And I was listening to this podcast about her. Well, it was on Radio 4 at the time. And it was a podcast that I think you can get on iPlayer. It was presented by Jarvis Cocker. And it was all about her and about how she wrote really kind of exquisitely about loneliness and outsiders and otherness. And she wrote brilliantly about the struggles of Black people in the American South, you know, before... It was quite rare for a white woman to... or white person... to write, you know, she was, I mean, I don't know whether this would happen today, but she was really kind of celebrated for the empathy that she had, you know, in her writing. So anyway, so he did this whole documentary about her, and there was this archive audio footage of her, and she said, "Sometimes it feels like everyone is part of a we except for me." And that really, like, struck me. It really... I was like, that's exactly what mental illness feels like. And I had this moment, I was listening to it and I was looking out on the common and there were like all of these people like exercising together. But then I thought, if that statistic we hear so much about, like one in four people will experience a mental health issue each year, is true. I'm literally within my field of vision, there's probably like 10 people who have experienced something this year. And yet there was, you know, there's nothing, there's no way of anyone coming together and talking about that, you know, or there's no kind of public way. And so I sort of went home and I said to my husband, I've had this idea. What if I do like walks and runs for people with mental health issues so they can get out of the house and they can get, and they know they can go somewhere to be with other people without fear of judgment? And he said to me, what if a load of nutters turn up? And I was like, that's the point. Anyway, I just sort of tweeted, you know, I've got this idea. Does anyone want to go for like a walk? And I'll be at this spot in this park on this date, which was Valentine's Day 2016, because like that's a shit day for everyone, whether you're like in a partner or not. I was desperate to meet other people like me who like experienced the same things I had, or who had this type of OCD that I had. And I knew they were out there, but there was no way of like coming out and saying you were there. And so I did. And to my amazement, 20 people showed up. And that was the start of Mental Health Mates, which is now, it's in 130 different towns and cities across the UK. And it's basically, it's peer support for people. And what it does is people volunteer and they are given the resources to be able to set up their own walk in their own area and meet like-minded people. And it's like getting bigger and bigger. And there's nothing like, apart from that original idea, it's now, it's all people wanting to connect with others. And so anyway, I always kind of quote Carson McCullers, but I wanted to kind of acknowledge her because she lived during a time where there was nothing. And she had, I think she had rheumatic fever as a child, and which meant she had a series of strokes when she was very young, and she was very unwell, and she tried to kill herself on a number of occasions, and she died eventually in her 50s of alcoholism. She had a brain hemorrhage. And her writing in itself is a thing of brilliance. Do you know what I mean? I just reread The Heart is a Lonely Hunter the other day. To have written at 23, it's like mind-blowing, you know? But to think that that can echo throughout the, you know, the time, and because of something she said that someone happened to record in like, I don't know, it was like the 30s, do you know what I mean? 1930s. And there was me all those years later, feeling sort of the same way. And, you know, it also reminds me that this stuff isn't, you know, we always talk about how there's an epidemic of mental health issues now as if it's a new thing. It's not a new thing. Like, people have always felt like this. People just haven't been able to talk about it. And she was one of the first people to properly talk about it and give voice to people that were, you know, were kind of, they were then described as kind of misfits and freaks and outcasts. So The Heart is a Lonely Hunter is, you know, it's about a mute deaf man and the people that sort of come to, they're inspired by him and they come and they're, but they're also sort of slightly other and sort of slightly seen as outcasts. And so I really wanted to kind of write a letter to her, not that I could match her writing, and just say, you know, thank you for existing. Thank you for speaking your truth. And know again that you've really helped a hell of a lot of people.
Do you feel like you have helped a lot of people?
Oh, I mean, people help them.
You should.
This is going back to like, no, I mean, God, no. I mean, I probably have, but I've only helped these people because I've needed to help myself. So like, I always say, like, this isn't, like, I was...
ultimately selfish.
No, but it was, because I was so desperate to meet other people like me, because people kept on saying, well, this is an illness. And I'd be like, but I think I'm literally the worst person in the world, because that's what it told me. And I sort of knew, like, intellectually that there were other people out there like me, but I had no... It was like a desperate, like, I'm going to write about this and talk about this in public with the platform that I have as a, you know, a jobbing hack on a newspaper. And I was so desperate, and it was sort of, it wasn't, there was no kind of plan. It was just, it was literally desperation. Like, please, 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 if you have this thing too, come and talk to me.
And I came along to one of the very early sessions of Mental Health Mates, and I made some friends there.
Really?
That I am still friends with.
No,
yeah.
Way.
And like, we still talk to each other online and stuff. Yeah.
I'd forgotten about that, Jess.
Yeah, it was at Clapham Common. I came because me and my husband were in London for the weekend, and we used to live in Brixton. Well, we used to stay there in when we were in London, and so Clapham is literally a walk away. And I said to my husband, I'm just going to go along and walk around with people. And he was like, yes, please do find somebody else who is as mad as you and is like, thinks that every, you know, I suffer from anxiety. And I went along and, yeah, I met some people there who also suffered from anxiety. And we walked around. I met your husband, I remember, and your kid in a buggy back then. And, yeah, I mean, I had actually with one of the women, I had like this sort of horrible moment where she'd written this brilliant thing about anxiety and I retweeted it. And then she was just getting loads of people being arseholes to her because I had retweeted it. And she sent me this thing saying, could you please like not, could you undo it please? Because I'm too anxious at the moment to deal with your horrible people, but all power to your elbow that you have to deal with these people. And that made me want to successfully work with some of the social media companies about putting in new things about pylons and how it, retweeting and blocking different conversations based on that meeting that I had at Clapham Common, based on me not wanting to inspire hatred against people who just deserved a platform for their brilliant ideas about anxiety. It's a brilliant idea, especially for people who are more fearful of, like, for want of a better word, sort of clinical, organised, therapeutic, sort of like, it's like a gateway drug, if you will, of saying, you know, I can go for a walk around a park and talk to other people who might be a bit like me. And then maybe I could think about going and speaking to a counsellor, or maybe I could think about going and asking for some medication. And I think it is a brilliant gateway drug.
And also, I think there's something quite powerful about walking and talking, because you're side by side. You don't have to look straight in the eye, which when you're suffering is really hard. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to leave the house when you're suffering. Do you know what I mean? Like, let's, I mean, just actually forget that. Scrap that. It's hard to get out of fucking bed. Do you know what I mean? So, like, it is, and the early walks, I remember, you'd see people turn up and they thought, if I don't go and give that person a hug right now, they're going to bolt it, you know? They're going to leave because they're like, what the fuck am I doing? This is, you know, silly. And then you'd give them a hug and then an hour later, you'd see them going off for coffee with people, you know? And it's like that ability to be able to talk about, like, how shit it's been to try and get, you know, therapy or something, or how hard it's been, or, you know, what's it like being on this? Did you have this thing? Do you know what I mean? And it isn't therapy. Like, we're very clear, it isn't therapy. But it is, like, it's fellowship, I guess. And again, I think the thing that has helped me most in getting better from my myriad mental health issues has been, like, the thing that has kept me in them is shame. Like, that sense that I am the worst person, that, like, shame keeps you sick. But I remember in treatment being told, like, shame dies when you expose it to the light. And when you find other people and you say, I have this thought, this is the thing, and they go, oh, that's, yeah, that's cool. That's, I have that too sometimes. And, like, remember when I was a little girl and I had these OCD thoughts, these intrusive thoughts, I was terrified of telling anyone them because I thought they are gonna, like, just, they're gonna call the police. They're gonna, like, I just thought they're gonna think I'm the worst person in the world. And, you know, it's batshit crazy for me to now think that I literally talk about them, like, on podcasts, on television. I write books about it. I write about, you know, like, the like, little Bryony, like, 9-year-old Bryony is like, no, that can't be me. That's obviously someone else. And, like, you know, so I know what it's like. And so, yeah, so meeting other people like you and realising you're not a freak, you're not awful, you're just a human with a brain, and brains are a bit, like, they misfire, like all of our organs do. And we don't, there's no kind of, like, special moral judgment when you've got, like, a skin condition or a heart or a heart defect, you know.
Yeah, that's it. Tennis elbow.
Yeah, people don't,
like,
go,
well, he was asking for that tennis elbow.
And people don't go, oh, she has to wear glasses, do you know what I mean? Like, it's her own fault. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, whereas stuff with the brain, people are like, oh, and I'm like, oh, fuck off. Just know you're normal, you're wonderful, you are, the most normal thing in the world is to feel weird, you know?
Yeah. Definitely. So how would you sign off to Castle McCullis?
I'd say you were part of a we, babes.
Oh no, that is what you should say. You were part of a we. Incidentally, my mum used to say to me, as a good socialist that she was, she used to say, it's we, not me, sweetheart. It's we that matters, not me.
I find my head is always in a much better place if I'm thinking of a we.
Well, Bryony, with your choices that were Bryony Gordon, which is my favourite one, I like that one, Andrea Colville and Casa McCullis, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, and you're definitely part of my we. And if you think I'm brilliant, then you just think, well, Jess can't be that bad because she thinks you're brilliant.
You are brilliant, and thank you. And, like, what a lovely, oh, what a lovely hour of my...
I know, it's like therapy.
I've loved it.
I'd had to try and, like, when I spoke to Lorraine, I'd spent the morning talking about dreadful cases of child sexual abuse, and then they were like, I hope you've got something slightly better later. And I said, oh, well, actually, I'm interviewing Lorraine for an hour, which is literally like eating cinnamon hot toast, isn't it? I was like, that
love it, Lorraine.
That's considerably better. Oh god, she's just the nicest
she's
woman.
She's so nice, isn't she? She's so, like, interested.
Yeah, it's like genuinely, yeah. She must be feigning some of that. But she seems like genuinely interested.
When someone from Love Island's on Lorraine. she really, like, I don't know. Will you come on my podcast?
Of course I will. I'll come on and talk about being mad.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips. If you want to hear more conversations just like this, make sure you follow Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips on the podcast provider of your choice. And why not write a letter to your friends telling them all about this podcast? And you can also follow us on social media. We're at Jess Phillips Pod. Goodbye.